You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 21st of March 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Andrew Muller. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, President Barack Obama continues his brisk tour of the Holy Land. We'll find out how it has been playing with people who've heard all the two-state solution stuff many, many times before.
If he will use the credit that he accumulates with the Israeli public to tell us unpleasant truths, then I will, in retrospect, justify his visit.
We'll be checking in with our editor-in-chief in Zurich.
There's been a series of, let's call them derailments, trains coming off the tracks. This has caused huge embarrassment. If you look at national icons, SBB is really held up as really one of the pillars almost of Swiss engineering know-how.
And our culture editor wishes that somewhere amid the acclaim in St. Peter's Square over the last week or so, someone had been gently booing.
St. Peter's looked like the wet-knickered Justin Bieber faithful. The crowd of cooing Catholics were clearly enraptured, and rightly so. There are few bigger days than this one for cats that dig transubstantiation, smells and bells, and pulling out.
And touched by the hand of Mod, with Mod on our side for Mod's sake, insert own preferred pun here, we'll speak to the author of a hefty new study of this most distinctively British of subcultures. All of that, plus we play some music as well, all coming up in the next hour here on Midori House. But ahead of all that, the headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
The US President Barack Obama has said that settlement building in the occupied West Bank did not advance the calls for peace, but he stopped short of demanding a construction freeze to enable negotiations to resume. Speaking at a joint news conference with the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, Obama said he remained committed to the creation of an independent, viable and contiguous Palestinian state, but said achieving that goal would not be easy.
The core issue right now is how do we get a sovereignty for the Palestinian people and how do we assure security for the Israeli people? If we solve those two problems, the settlement problem will be solved. And I've been clear with Prime Minister Netanyahu that it has been the United States policy that we do not consider settlement activity to be something that can advance the cause of peace.
The Turkish Interior Minister Munammer Gula has strongly condemned the fact there were no Turkish flags at the Kurdish Nowruz New Year celebrations in Diyarbakir. Hundreds of thousands of Kurds attended the celebrations to listen to a written message from the jailed Kurdish rebel leader Abdullah Öcalan, ordering his fighters to cease fire and withdraw from Turkish soil as a step to ending a conflict that has killed 40,000 people. Here, religious leaders from all faiths, politicians and Prince Charles and the Duchess of Cornwall gathered at Canterbury Cathedral today to watch the enthronement of the new Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby. The 57-year-old was sworn in as the head of the Church of England and the spiritual leader of the world's 77 million Anglicans. Welby is a former oil man who gave up a high salary to train as a priest. He has big challenges ahead and inherits a church which is declining in numbers and is divided on issues like women bishops and sexuality. Welby is firmly against gay marriage, but he said not homosexuals.
It's a rather more complex one. The Church of England holds very firmly to the traditional view of marriage, that it's a lifelong union of one man with one woman. But at the same point, our sense that human beings have incredible dignity and value in themselves means we have to stand and do stand very, very strongly against any kind of homophobia.
Employees of the Cyprus Popular Bank clashed with police outside Parliament today after rumours that the country's second biggest lender may be sold. The government is trying to find a way to finance a bailout. Cyprus has so far rejected the terms of an EU bailout. The former foreign minister, Marcos Kyprianou, was hopeful the island nation would survive the crisis.
There is only one target, to save our economy and our country. I believe that the political parties will show the necessary responsibility for the survival of Cypriot economy.
The main union The main United Nations Human Rights Forum has urged Sri Lanka to carry out credible investigations into killings and disappearances that took place during its nearly 30-year civil war that ended in 2009. The 47-member Geneva Forum adopted the resolution, with 25 countries in favour, including India, and 13 against, including Pakistan, which considers the resolution as a politicised intrusion. The United States Ambassador to the UN, Eileen Donoghue, said Sri Lanka must take meaningful action.
We are not satisfied with the progress to date, which is why we felt the need to go forward with this resolution. No determination has been made by the council members yet as to whether an international probe is required. What we're hoping for is a domestic, credible, independent investigation that satisfies the people of Sri Lanka. That has not happened to date. That's what's being called for this year.
And finally, scientists in Norway say a pre-Viking woolen tunic found beside a thawing glacier in the south of the country shows how global warming is proving something of a boon for archaeology. The greenish-brown, loose-fitting outer clothing, suitable for a person up to 5 foot 9 inches tall, was found nearly 7,000 feet above sea level on what may have been a Roman-era trade route in southern Norway. Carbon dating showed it was made around 300 AD. And that's the latest news from Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. I wonder if it belonged to a Viking called Thor. It's 1806 here in London. There's plenty more where that came from. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Welcome back to Midori House, live from Studio One in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Rarely has a visitor to the Holy Land seemed quite so reluctant. This week's visit by President Barack Obama to Israel and the Palestinian territories has had something of the feel of a resentfully dutiful son wearily making the rounds of rancorous relatives at Christmas. While Obama has cranked out the standard boilerplate about two-state solutions, partners for peace, and so forth, he has not given the impression that his heart is entirely in it. And unlike several of his predecessors, he probably feels no obligation to go truffling for a legacy in the sands of Arabia. This president already has a Nobel Peace Prize. Well, earlier, Monocle's Jerusalem correspondent Joseph Dana spoke to Israeli lawyer and press corps favourite Daniel Sederman. He began by asking him how it feels to be a resident of Jerusalem while the president is in town.
It's really interesting. I think initially most Jerusalemites treat this like a snow day. You know that your routine is going to be disrupted. It's like Los Angeles. You don't know if it's going to take you 10 minutes to get somewhere or 2 hours or 3 hours. And there is a thin veneer of cynicism. Why do we have to put up with this? Here it comes again. Why can't they do this in Tel Aviv? What did we do to deserve this? But what's interesting is that that veneer kind of cracks fairly rapidly. And you also detect, with all of the burdens that are imposed, people get excited. It's an event that quickens the pulse, contrary to the cynicism that is there and exists.
So what's been the general kind of sentiment that you've been hearing about Obama? Because we all know that he's been a very, let's say, controversial president so far.
It's clear that Obama is on a charm offensive. And he's trying to win over Israeli hearts and minds. And everybody knows it. And one would assume that since everybody knows it, it's not going to work. On the other hand, Israelis are suckers for flattery, for legitimacy, for hearing kind words. Aren't we all? But I think we're a bit more susceptible than most. The more that President Obama reaches out to my compatriots in Israel, the more suspect a quantity he becomes in Palestine. And you see in the protests in Iwan, in the demonstrations in Ramallah and in Bethlehem, which are not far from here, it's just a few miles away, messages being sent through these protests. We're not going to be extras in your Cecil B. DeMille charm offensive in Israel. We're here. We have to be counted. We're equal. And we're watching you, and we don't like what we're seeing.
A lot has been said about how Palestinians feel almost insulted about this visit. And a lot has been said about how pro-Israel Obama's statements have been so far. Do you see that as a kind of dichotomy for the greater conflict at this point?
I, from the get-go, thought that this visit was a gamble for the president, and I haven't changed my mind. An inconsequential visit by the president of the United States at a time that is very tense, where there's no political process in place, there's a lot of frustration and a lot of volatile gases, I think has the potential of contributing to a further deterioration in the conflict. Now, it's wrong to do a close-up on this. I think that it is necessary for the president to have the trust of the Israeli public in order to move forward. What the Palestinians are saying is, all we're seeing is you courting their trust and not moving forward. That is a sentiment that I can identify with.
Obama's coming here to win over the hearts and minds of Israeli society. Do you believe that mainstream Israeli society has heard what it wanted to hear? Do you believe that he's so far won over those hearts and minds?
I genuinely think that Obama is pro-Israel. I don't think he's hostile to Israel. I think he's hostile to the occupation of Palestine, and that for reasons of political expediency has not translated that into policy. If he will use the credit that he accumulates with the Israeli public to tell us unpleasant truths, then I will, in retrospect, justify his visit. In some ways, Israeli occupation reminds me of Thomas Jefferson's quip about slavery. Slavery is like holding a wolf by the ears. You're scared to hold on and you don't dare let go. Most Israelis are not enamored with the occupation. We go into denial mode, escapism mode. We don't like to look at it, but we're very uncomfortable with it and we're scared to let go of it. In order for Israel to let go of this wolf, we have to have assurances about our legitimate fears, but we're going to need help from friends. And those friends are not only going to be able to have to talk about nanotechnology and making the desert flourish, they're going to have to tell us, you Israelis are engaged not only in destructive policies vis-a-vis the Palestinians, you're engaged in suicidal policies vis-a-vis the Israeli enterprise. If President Obama leverages the credit that he accumulates in that direction, nobody will be happier than me.
It's Daniel Seidemann talking to Joseph Dana, and Joseph joins me now from Ramallah. Joseph, welcome to the program. Just bring us up to date. What did you see today?
Well, Ramallah and Jerusalem, the entire area kind of shut down this afternoon because Obama actually visited Ramallah and gave a couple of remarks with the Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas. And then he immediately kind of shuttled back in a helicopter back to Jerusalem and gave his major kind of policy address of this trip to a convention center filled with Israeli youth. And this has really been, it's kind of the meatiest aspect of Obama coming to the region and kind of, you know, establishing his positions on what's going on vis-a-vis the Israeli-Palestinian situation.
I read through the text of Obama's speech shortly before coming on air. It seemed to me to be saying that all at once that Israel needs to change course and yet the United States will support Israel no matter what.
That's exactly the feeling that kind of came out of this speech. It was probably one of the most pro-Israel speeches that an American president has ever given. It was strongly reaffirming the kind of Jewish and Zionist character of the Israeli state. Lots of very flowery language about the relationship, the strong and unbreakable relationship between the United States and Israel. And then Obama arrived at the kind of difficult, let's call it tough love aspect of his speech, in which he said quite clearly, you know, no wall is big enough to kind of protect Israeli security interests. No Iron Dome missile battery system is advanced enough to protect these interests. And therefore, a Palestinian state, a viable, independent Palestinian state, is in the interest of Israel in terms of its long-term security interests. And so this is really the big kind of takeaway from the speech, but, you know, in terms of getting to that point of having a Palestinian state, it wasn't that clear as to the concrete steps that can be taken.
The line I thought was interesting was where he did address one of the rarely acknowledged fundamental truths of the whole fiasco, which is the demographic reality, as he put it, of what lies west of the Jordan River, which is that unless Israel does reach some sort of accommodation with a Palestinian state, then the Jewish character of Israel will be overwhelmed.
Well, this is absolutely correct, and I think that in Daniel Seideman's remarks, you kind of hear that from that more, you know, traditional two-state liberal Israeli perspective, that the writing is kind of on the wall, and that these Israeli settlements that are cropping up all over the West Bank and will most likely continue and maybe even surge after Obama leaves because of the complexion of the new Israeli government are creating facts on the ground that will be very difficult to unravel vis-a-vis the demographics of the situation, vis-a-vis the numbers of Palestinians and Israeli Jews. And so that's one of the reasons why this visit is so important, and it's another reason why the Palestinian leadership was very keen to hear some strong language on the settlement enterprise of Israel and maybe some sort of forceful steps. But that so far has not come out of this visit.
Do you think there's any likelihood at all that this visit by President Obama will actually change anything?
It's very difficult to say. I think that we will begin to see some very concrete changes. I mean, we do have to keep in mind that the new Israeli government is one of the most pro-settlement kind of right-wing governments in the history of the country. And so now that Obama has been here and he hasn't really been incredibly strong on condemning the settlement project and kickstarting, at least in terms of, you know, real terms, an Israeli-Palestinian peace process, I think the only thing that we can really expect is more settlements and thus more kind of entrenchment of the status quo, which is so dangerous. And so I think in the short term it's going to be a bit messy, but maybe we'll see in a couple of months that this visit had actually changed some hearts and minds for the better.
Joseph Dana in Ramallah, thanks very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
All this week on Monocle 24, 10 years after the war in Iraq began, we unpick the military campaign and the turbulent aftermath to deliver our verdict on the conflict. Every day, we'll be hearing from the key figures who shaped the action, including the journalists and policymakers who watched from the sidelines and the generals who gave the orders.
When their plan, which was to take over the levers of power and put other hands on those levers, failed, there was no plan B. There was no second course.
The Iraq War, 10 years on, all this week on Monocle 24.
The Review is Monocle 24's weekly review and preview of the arts. Every Saturday, we take a relaxed look back at the books, TV shows, films, music, theatre, and events that have made our week, while looking around the corner to scout out the next big thing.
It doesn't feel sappy, it doesn't feel sentimental, it does have a certain heft.
It's very Darwinian. The shows that do well run and the ones that don't close, and there have been some quite high-profile flops and some great successes as well.
For me, it's riotous, it's tasteless, but it's actually dynamic as well, it has momentum.
Join Monocle's editors as they sit down with our favourite critics, opinion makers and key industry figures for some in-depth discussion and lively debate. And we provide inspiration for the weekend from cities around the world.
It's a real divider because I know some people just love this film and other people really just hate it.
That's A Review, every Saturday at midday London time and across the weekend, right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. Our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, is in Zurich and discovering that even in a country which has made itself a byword for seamless efficiency in both transport and retail, things can still find a way to go wrong. Monocle's news editor, Tom Edwards, spoke to Tyler earlier.
Let's talk about what's making the news where you are. Now, I gather that, we traditionally have very high expectations of the rail system there, but all is not quite so rosy. Is that fair to say?
No, there's a slagging match happening right now between SBB, of course, which is a Swiss Federal Railways, and also parliamentarians in Bern. There's been a series of let's call them derailments. Now, we're not talking about maybe derailments as we've seen in other parts of the world where there have been fatalities and certainly scenes of horror, but nevertheless, trains coming off the tracks. And this has caused huge embarrassment. If you look at national icons, SBB is really held up as really one of the pillars almost of not just really Swiss engineering know-how, but also it's really a social brand in this country as well. And you now have SBB saying, look, you a decade ago, you cut our budgets. We weren't able to invest in infrastructure. But more importantly, we weren't able to invest in personnel who have to maintain these rails. And so this has caused a bit of friction and burn at the moment.
So who tends to carry the can when you get these kind of spats there, Tyler? Is it something where the people who are immediately in charge of the projects tend to pick up the blame, or do people look to the government and look to the state? How does the blame tend to get apportioned?
Well, I think that one of the curious things here is that where we've seen in so many parts of Europe and the world that a lot of big infrastructure initiatives, and certainly anything that has to do with transport operations, have been spun off over the last two decades, Tom, and whether you look at a state airline or a former state airline like British Airways, of course, becoming a fully public company, SBB as an entity is part of the state, and it is seen as an essential service. So, I think in this case, it is, and again, many would say that those people working at SBB are also bureaucrats. They are also part of the public purse. So I think that, the blame will fall in both ways. It's interesting to see, though, how SBB is hitting back at the government.
So that's the railways. What about on the trams? Is it a happier story on those rails?
It is a happier story if you're in the hard term district of Zurich. Now, as you would know, our editor Andrew Tuck loves a bit of a tram story on his program, The Urbanist. He has spent a lot of time on the very fine rails, very fine tram rails of Zurich itself, and it's been an interesting theme, because if you're looking at a defining element also of transport culture in this city, Zurich's blue and white trams again are really it, and the city has become a model for so many others in how you implement trams, whether it's sort of right-of-way issues, also the payment system. In Zurich, it's based on a time issue. When you buy a card, it is not it's not point-to-point. It's also on an honor system as well, but heaven forbid you get nailed by one of the inspectors, and there are many in Switzerland. So they're investing further, and so in sort of, the sort of Escherwiesplatz area, there's going to be a new tram line going out this way, and you're looking at sort of continued growth. There is this real boom as you head out towards Basel, and then also you would say sort of a little bit down to the southwest of the city as well. This is a very affordable area. You're seeing a lot more housing development going in this area. This is really seen as really the boom center of Switzerland, and of course they're talking about something in the area of 14,000 new residences that need to be built here as well, because we're seeing so many multinationals, of course, relocating to Zurich.
So that's the big transport and infrastructure picture. What about retail-wise, Tyler? Because I gather that on Bahnhofstrasse, some of the old favourites are maybe shipping out, and the new brooms are moving in.
Well, yes, one of the most iconic stores on the Bahnhofstrasse has been the Bally store, which is around the corner from the big Yale Moly department store. And this was really a fixture of really fantastic architecture. It was, of course, Bally is a brand that has had many owners, and it's gone through a great number of reinventions over the years. But of course, here you also have the Bahnhofstrasse is one of the most respected shopping streets in Europe. And of course, many with the deepest pockets right now are the major high street brands. And one of those companies, which is continually celebrated for its great achievements and really being a sign that parts of Spain are still working, is Inditex's Zara. And I think there's a few sad faces in the city. This wonderful Bally, almost department store, is going to become a massive Zara store right now. And then you've got a lot of Swiss brands, like companies like Modissa and Felpage. These are companies which are very much mid-market, really part of the Swiss retail establishment. They're having to up their game now. They're launching cafes, etc. So you have this reinvention of the street, but probably going for more sort of the upper middle market. Still, of course, the likes of Hermes and Cartier, they're unlikely to be pushed out.
And that was Monocle's editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé talking to our news editor Tom Edwards. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's now time for our daily monologue, and today we turn to our culture editor Rob Bound, who takes a long, hard look at the somewhat craven coverage of the recent swap of Benedict for Francis in the Vatican's top job, and wishes a balcony somewhere around St. Peter's Square had been reserved for Statler and Waldorf, or one of their much-missed heirs.
All this Pope-tastic news coverage is making me miss Christopher Hitchens more than ever. What this underarm bowling, this cheesy media love-in needs is a great dissenting voice, the other side of the story, some righteous indignation, a devil's advocate, a role, in fact, that Hitchens actually took on for the Vatican as detailed in his book Love, Poverty and War. What the world needs now is reason, sweet reason. On Tuesday, the rolling news channels covered, with a cloying holiday humour, the inauguration of the new Pope. St. Peter's looked like the wet-knickered Justin Bieber faithful. The crowd of cooing Catholics were clearly enraptured, and rightly so. There are few bigger days than this one for cats that dig transubstantiation, smells and bells, and pulling out. It's a big day, and yay, let's celebrate. But it's been a pretty poor show by the news. There's been talk of the challenges that lay ahead for Pope Francis, as if he's a football manager contending with an over-enfranchised dressing room and an unenviable position at the bottom of the league. Indeed, many cardinals and Catholic commentators see Pope Francis as a sort of Holy Harry Redknapp, an oft-hired English saviour manager, but here's a Houdini in robes rather than an Umbro Parker. In fact, these Catholic challenges are a messed up attitude to contraception, homosexuality, child abuse, and seemingly the entire continent of Africa. Challenge is a mega euphemism in this case. It's as if the very Vatican itself is the rock that Francis must forever roll up the hill. Overcoming these Catholic disorders is a Sisyphean task. I'm not sure what Hitch would say, but the man who described Mother Teresa, he might even place that proper pronoun in inverted commas, as according to Hitchens she styled herself Mother Teresa, Hitch called her a fanatic, a fundamentalist and a fraud, and I think he'd have been a formidable, enlightening and entertaining commentator on goings-on in thought and dialogue outside of St. Peter's Square. And there is a lot of world and a lot of thought and dialogue outside of St. Peter's Square. My bullshit detector squealed into the red last week when the man that was Cardinal Jorge Bergoglio was chosen and was seen to have played a blinder on the Vatican balcony by greeting the simpering with buonanotte instead of what? Something in Latin, presumably. Ah, he's just so human, the media toadishly concurred. God, the Queen of England pretended to jump out of a helicopter for a comedy sketch at the Olympics last year. Get with the unfogeyizing of fogeyish offices programme, you squares. Cannily, the Pope then went on to thank the world's media for its interest in the papal process in English, the language of the world's media, which was gratefully, slavishly recorded, as if they'd touched the hem of his garment or something, just by being addressed in the impersonal third-person plural. Really, Papa, thank you. We're not worthy. Christopher Hitchens, the great essayist, interlocutor, to-task-taker, and keeper of the tinderbox with which to reignite the flame of reason, would have been a good sport on this cosy scrum of docility. While Francis gets used to a life of not cooking his own meals and not riding the bus to work, and therefore presumably not nattering to the other oldies in dresses down at the laundrette, the civilised world misses Hitch. For Monocle, I'm Robert Bound.
And that was indeed Robert Bound lamenting the lack of a devil's advocate at the recent Vatican shenanigans. And with that, it's time for our first song of the evening, and keeping it suitably irreverent, verging on the heretical if not iconoclastic, this is Tom Lehrer with the Vatican Rag. Absent a lightning strike, the news headlines will follow.
Wafer, 2, 4, 6, 8, time to transubstantiate. So get down upon your knees, fiddle with your rosaries. Bow your head with great respect and genuflect, genuflect, genuflect. Make a cross on your abdomen. When in Rome, do like a Roman. Ave Maria, gee, it's good to see you. Getting ecstatic and sort of dramatic and doing the Vatican rag.
Tom Lehrer with The Vatican Rag. In the next half hour of Midori House, we will meet the author of a new book celebrating all things mod and speak to the editor of Brazil's new arts channel. But before all that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thank you very much. The US President Barack Obama, on a visit to Israel and the West Bank, has said that settlement building in the occupied West Bank did not advance the cause of peace, but he stopped short of demanding a construction freeze to enable negotiations to resume. Employees of the Cyprus Popular Bank have clashed with police outside Parliament today after rumours that the country's second biggest lender may be sold. The main United Nations Human Rights Forum has urged Sri Lanka to carry out credible investigations into killings and disappearances that took place during its nearly 30-year civil war that ended in 2009. And here, religious leaders from all faiths, politicians, Prince Charles and the Duchess of Cornwall, gathered at Canterbury Cathedral today to watch the enthronement of the new Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby. And that's the latest news from Monocle 24.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. There is little arguing with Britain's massive contribution to late 20th century popular culture, but much of the music and much of the fashion associated with British rock and roll were derivations of or reactions to what was happening in the United States. A plausible exception to this observation is mod, the 60s original subculture whose frames of reference have always been almost exclusively British. A new book chronicling the phenomenon and its legacy bears the apposite title Mod, a very British style, and joining me now is the author, Richard Waite. Richard, welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
What was it about mod that fascinated you sufficiently to write 400 pages about it?
What fascinated me about it was, here is this youth culture, really Britain's first youth culture. If you look at the rockers of the 50s that the mods famously had battles with, yes, they had, you know, they used style to rebuke all kinds of snobbery in the country, but they were very, very Americanized. And what mod did was, it was this unique, and is this uniquely British fusion of American style and European style. And by style, I don't just mean clothes. What the mods adored about continental Europe was everything from the cappuccino to the scooter. And you've got to remember, this is late 50s Britain. Their fathers would have, they associated Europe with war. Germans and Italians, as far as they were concerned, had fought on the wrong side. So when these guys said, I love a cappuccino, I love a scooter, I love Bauhaus design, which the original mods did, a lot of them were art and design students at St. Martin's College here in London, they were rebuking their parents by engaging with the pop culture of Europe. Now, it wasn't an anti-American thing, and that's what's really interesting about mod, and what's interesting, you know, made me want to write this book. It was a pro-American, but also very pro-European, and it was a culture, an attempt to fuse the two. It's a uniquely British hybrid of America and Europe.
That's a potential preemptive answer to my next question, because it's always struck me that unlike most rebellious youth subcultures, and it did have that element of rebellion about it, I guess most famously exemplified in the fight scenes in Quadrophenia, it was always kind of, mod was always kind of defined by its uptightness, if you were. There was sort of very closely observed strictures about the clothes, about haircuts, and even the music. There's few open chords. It's all very tightly wound.
It is very tightly wound, and there is a strand within mod culture from the original mods of kind of, you know, the jazz, modern jazz fans. That's where it got its name from. These guys were modern jazz fans. They were into Miles Davis, not Elvis Presley. From the modern jazz fans that used to hang out at Ronnie Scott's in Soho, right up to kind of the Brit poppers of the 90s. Mod has had what I call a mod Taliban. There's a purism about it. I mean, I've encountered it myself.
It's an image to conjure with.
You're not listening to the right thing. You're not wearing the right thing. And actually, what mod was about, as I said, was this uniquely British hybrid. It was about, and also taking stuff from the Caribbean as well, you know, the pork pie hat, for example. So it's always been about a hybrid. So that kind of puritanical attitude within mod, you're quite right, it was their quite uptight attitude, is in a sense very un-mod.
You also mentioned there that appropriation of influences from the Caribbean, which is an interesting quirk of mod, because as well as being somewhat uptight, you could argue, one of the other defining characteristics of mod is that it's extremely white, at least in its visual image, certainly. Where did the kind of influence of ska and Northern Soul come from?
Well, the early mods, the 50s and 60s, adored the black music of America, primarily soul music. In fact, one of the continuing strands in mod is the love of soul music in its various forms. It's why 70s mods were into Bowie. But also, Jamaican ska music. So mod, in a sense, is a white working class British engagement with the black music and culture of America and the Caribbean. But, and there are some, again, the mod Taliban who say, well, it's essentially working class. But actually, one of the really interesting things about mod is that because it was very neat, it was all about neat, it was all about being smart, about dressing as well as your boss, saying, you know, you might have gone to Eton and I might have gone to the local comprehensive, but my suit is cut as well as yours. So it was always about kind of working class aspiration, social mobility. And those white working class mods, it actually appealed to middle classes, because if you think about hippie culture, it was all about, to some extent, dropping out, going back to a kind of a pre-industrial, rural thing. If you look at punk, it was about spitting in the face of the modern world, whereas hippies were kind of trying to escape from it. Mod was about embracing the modern world, and that appealed, I think, to a lot of middle class youth who looked at these working class guys who were saying, don't look down your nose at me. But they were actually saying it with a sardonic smile while tightening their ties.
Do you think there was something, and I mean big C, conservative about mod?
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at the very first time that the national media in this country noticed this weird little subcult, London subcult, was in 1962, when the great photographer Don McCullen was sent to Stamford Hill to interview a small group of Jewish teenage mods. Many of the early mods were Jewish. And he found this very uptight 15-year-old Mark Feld, later Mark Bolan, who said, I'm a conservative. Conservatives are about social mobility. I don't think he used the word social mobility, but they're about, I think he said, making money, and I want to make money. And in fact, if you look at the mod revival in the 70s, what horrified people at the time who thought that youth culture was necessarily a liberal progressive thing was you had mods in the late 70s saying, yeah, I love Thatcher. So, you know, there is a very conservative strain within it sometimes.
And it never quite goes away. We always seem to be somewhere on the trajectory of a mod revival. Notwithstanding Bradley Wiggins' haircut, where is it at the moment, do you think?
I think, there are two kinds of revival. Said there's the one that you had in the late 70s, where you had the bizarre sight of people in the punk era getting their mothers and fathers' clothes out of the 60s wardrobe and just putting them on again. You've got that kind of revival, which is quite, you know, based on 60s nostalgia. But the revivals that there've been in the Britpop and the rave eras, and the one that's happening at the moment, yes, it's partly driven by Bradley Wiggins and, you know, and celebrity culture, but really the revival is about an attitude. At the end of the day, if you think about the music that's attached to mod, there isn't really a mod soundtrack. It was Miles Davis, then it was The Who, then it was Bowie, Oasis, and so on. So there's no one musical genre it's attached to. In terms of fashion, yes, it is located in a certain kind of very crisp early 60s style, but again, that's been riffed on by subsequent generations. So what we come down to at the end, what is mod a very British style? It's actually an attitude. It's an attitude that actually uses style to rebuke all kinds of social prejudices, class, racial, whatever. And I think in that sense, that it goes on regenerating itself over the years, despite what the mod Taliban might want to it to be.
Richard Waite, author of Mod, A Very British Style, thank you very much for joining us. And thank you very much also for mentioning The Who. Here they are. My washing done. Substitute. The Who and Substitute. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Next, we're going to Brazil.
Each Sunday on Monocle 24, we like to take stock.
The wonder of history for the journalist is you can delve into this immense booty of information.
I don't even know what to think about that.
Take the Global Pulse.
I was at a bunga bunga party the other day.
And?
I wasn't at all. I just wanted to start a show like that. We're at 187 shows down. How's your week been?
I'm feeling 187, actually.
And occasionally take things down a notch, too.
I had a pair of plum suede loafers with gold snaffles. The guy stopped his car and leant out of the window and said it was people like me who were bringing this country to its knees.
To end the week with the best chat.
We know that he had them and we know that he used them before.
Because we still had the receipts.
Well, there's that.
Some great music.
Do you know, I never thought that I might need to have a question about death metal, but I'm warming up.
And some good fun to set up Sunday and warm the week ahead. The Monocle Weekly. Your week starts here.
Monocle Magazine is an essential monthly briefing of affairs, business, culture, design, and travel. For £90 sterling, we'll deliver the whole year round to your home, regardless of where that might be. That's 10 issues, plus our summer and winter newspapers, Mediterraneo and Alpino. And our exclusive Monocle tote bag, designed by our creative team. Plus, all annual subscriptions allow you access to our extensive online archive. So subscribe today for a year of essential briefings. Monocle, keeping an eye on the world.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. For a country with a rich artistic heritage and an avidly consumed televisual culture, it does seem weird that Brazil does not have a television station dedicated to the arts. That is about to change with this week's launch of ARTE1, a 24-hour channel covering cinema, literature, opera, theatre and pop. And joining me now is the editor-in-chief of this new enterprise, Gisele Carto. Welcome to the show. Why hasn't there been a channel like this in Brazil before now?
Yeah, hi Andrew. Great pleasure to talk to you. I'm a big fan of Monaco, and it's very weird indeed. And I don't know, but we are very excited about ARTE1. That is the name of our channel, totally dedicated to arts and culture. And the Brazilian culture is so strong in so many ways, and I think it's going to be great to have a channel dedicated to that.
Okay, well, we have a clip, I think, of some of your output, which we will play right now.
Arte 1. Tudo sobre arte em só canal. 24 horas de programação especializada em arte para a audiência mais qualificada da TV.
And for our non-Portuguese-speaking listeners, can you explain what we were listening to there?
Yeah, we're saying that the ARTE1 is a channel that for all the people who like art and culture, and that our goal is always to have shows with a very high quality, but to talk to everyone, not only an audience that is already used to this kind of subject.
Aside from your new channel, what is missing from cultural coverage on Brazilian television now?
I think we cover all the mass phenomena, you know, like the music that is already on the radio and in magazines, and the people listen in the streets. But we are going to show exhibitions and concerts and things that people are not used to go or to listen, and we think that they might like it, but they only don't like it right now because they don't have access to this kind of shows.
And will you be focusing principally on high culture, or will you be covering popular culture as well?
No, high culture.
Okay, and will it just be Brazilian high culture, or will you also be broadcasting foreign culture for Brazilian viewers?
No, we are going to be in Brazil, and we are going to be also in the United States, and some countries that speak Portuguese. And then our shows are covering Brazilian culture, and we are producing shows here, and we are also buying a lot of shows from other international TVs like BBC, Arte, Rai, and TF1. So we are going to be an international program.
Is the timing important of the launch of your new channel? Obviously, with a World Cup and an Olympic Games coming up in the next few years, there's going to be an awful lot of attention paid to Brazil. Are you hoping to use this as an opportunity to display Brazilian culture to the rest of the world?
Yeah, I hope so. And I think we have a lot of big artists in a lot of the visual arts, Brazilian visual arts, increasing a lot. We have a lot of names, Adriana Varejão, Cildo Mirelles, and in high cuisine also Alex Atala is a big name of ours. So we want to show these wonderful artists to the public.
Well, we wish you all the very best with it. Gisele Carto, Editor-in-Chief of New Brazilian Arts Channel, ARTE1, which launched this week. Thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. It is 18, coming up for 18:51 here in London, and it's time now, towards the close of the show, to summon one of our editors from upstairs to get them to talk about what's in their section of the current issue. It's Thursday, and that means Section D, which means design, which means the design editor, Hugo MacDonald. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Andrew.
And what do you have in Section D this week?
Well, it's actually the design section of the magazine, just to separate it from Section D, which is the design show on Monocle 24.
Indeed. Well, yes.
It gets confusing. People are confused the whole time, myself included. In the design section of the latest issue of Monocle, we open with a profile of a man that I think hardly anybody will have heard of called...
Try me.
Well, he's called Niels de Vriend.
You're right. I mean, I've heard of him in that his name is in the script, but had somebody
5 minutes ago,
yeah, had somebody asked me earlier today who is Niels de Vriend and who did he play for, then I would have been I would have been struggling. Enlighten us.
Well, what attracted me to him was the fact that I'd never heard of him either, but he is an 80-year-old American designer living and working still in his little Connecticut studio. And he's being heralded as the godfather of ergonomic design, in that he was the first person to look at x-rays of the human spine and apply the way that the spine bent in different positions, be it standing or sitting, and took that knowledge and designed chairs for not just sort of seats for everyday life, but aeroplane chairs, chairs for everything from tractors right through to space shuttles, all incorporating the knowledge of what happens to the spine when you sit in a particular way.
So he's one of those genuinely impressive creative genius types who prefers to actually just do good work rather than charge around the place attracting attention to himself.
Exactly, exactly. Wow. He's very much function over form. One of his quotes from the piece says that he never ever thinks about how something will look before he begins. The worst thing in his mind would be to predict what anything will look like. And as a result, we probably have him to thank for the fact that office chairs are quite ugly. it's very, I mean, it's something that you can't underestimate, the impact that he has had and the fact that people do not know him. He's not a household name like Philippe Starck, for instance, who is probably, most people would say, the most famous designer in the world.
And who sounds as a character pretty much the polar opposite.
Exactly. He puts himself in front of everything that he designs rather than just spends hours looking at one vertebra in the spine and working out how he can translate that into a more comfortable airline seat.
What has Niels de Vriend's influence been? Where might people listening to us have seen or indeed sat on his work?
Well, he's worked for most of the great American chair manufacturers. And those are Human Scale, Knoll, Herman Miller. And those chairs really are to be found in most offices around the world. But also he worked at a very formative period for American Airlines and was responsible for developing how the modern airline seat worked across all different classes. Anybody who's driven a tractor, I don't know if that's you.
It's been a while.
Well, Niels de Vriendt worked for John Deere in the 60s and 70s and designed the modern tractor cabin. Whilst he was working for John Deere as well, he did a spell redesigning the American electricity pylon. That's not so much to do with ergonomics, but it was a little side job for him. He's someone that has touched sort of daily life for certainly most Americans and probably the majority of the world in one way or another, but kept his name very far out of the limelight.
He does sound an absolutely extraordinary and influential character. Is he asked in the piece why he's kept his name out of the limelight?
Yeah, and it's precisely for that point that we touched on a little earlier, the fact that he says his designs or his goal just to make life a little bit better through the work that he does is all that he wants. He finds the whole way that sort of design in inverted commas has gone nowadays as a sort of celebrity show repulsive and completely against what the whole ethos of making things better, which is how he defines design, should be about. He says that people who are celebrities or court celebrity from the things that they make really are the spawn of the devil.
It's amazing how, in the modern world, how heretical that position sounds, doesn't it? The guy who could be famous but decides he doesn't want to and can't be bothered with it.
I know. I mean, I'm not sure that that can really exist anymore nowadays, because I see so many young designers who, for a start, they get taught in universities by the stars, and so that's instantly who they aspire to. But it's partly the fault of the manufacturers as well, who are the key to these designers being successful, not just being successful as a celebrity, but actually being successful in terms of having their prototype put into production. Those manufacturers only really want to work with somebody who they feel they can market and push and put in front of the product as much as the product itself.
Which is weird, and it clearly he thinks it's weird, because you can understand how or why it's just about necessary to put a marketable personality out in front of a song or a book or a TV program or a film, but something that is, yes, supposed to be functional. But the idea that celebrity or the lure of celebrity has even infested or indeed infected something which is supposed to be utilitarian and practical.
Exactly. Everything has to have a face and a personality and a tagline. And if it's a beautiful woman that has designed the office chair, then it's probably easier to sell that office chair. It's a sad marker of our times, isn't it?
Are there any young designers that you know of who are rebelling against that and just trying to actually just design stuff for the sake of designing stuff?
Well, very much so. I don't know if you've heard of Jasper Morrison.
Again, probably for exactly this reason. No, I haven't.
Okay, well, he is a celebrity designer in that his name has trickled outside the design industry itself. But he really eschews any interviews, any profiles, portraits or anything. But he's sort of been dragged into the designer pen or the celebrity pen just because his work is so good and it speaks for itself. And he gets commissioned time and time again because his name is a bankable name now. He's in his 50s, probably maybe even early 60s now. In terms of young people who are good enough just to let their work stand for itself and don't have to do the whole media marketing push that goes with it, sadly, I don't know any.
The trouble is, if you take too much of a stand or too much of a strident stand against marketing, then people assume that's some sort of marketing ploy in itself.
That's the thing. I know you can go too far the other direction.
You really, really can't win. What is this remarkable man working on right now?
Well, right now he is working for Human Scale, which is an American office chair company. But at the end of the piece, he says that he's very interested in working in the fashion industry. And he's been spending a lot of time studying pockets on men's trousers, working out how actually they could be, with a subtle sort of nip and tuck here and there, they could function much better.
He sounds a genuinely and quietly heroic figure. Hugo MacDonald, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, or rather you have been listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. That is all we have time for. Thanks to our producer, Steve Bloomfield, the researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Barbara Feeney, and our studio manager, Chris Fitch. Next up, it's the urbanist, Andrew Tuck, is this week taking a look at sharing in the city, from an office share in London to the website uniting would-be gardeners with patches to sow their seeds in Vancouver.
I think that they're going to have close to 20 plots. It can only build community and make better use of the land.
I will be back in about 3 hours and 80 seconds with the Monocle Daily with Emma Nelson, and Emma will also be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, I've been Andrew Muller. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.